to catch this before anyone else. Now no one has to see it, Layla says as she tears the photograph very gently. Seema would have to rely on her words, scold her daughter in a general way that Amira would be unable to deny, but also be unable to trace back to Amar's box. Seema is offended, that much is clear. But more than that, she is humiliated. And she shakes her head in disbelief, maybe hoping that Layla will have no more to say. Layla knows what it is like for one moment to change your understanding of your child drastically. For a stranger to come into her home to tell her of her daughter's doing, it is no easy blow. It is clear they have lied to us both, and clear that they meet. I don't know how often. I left the letters as they were, but they gave me reason to believe there is much more to be concerned about. Layla sips her tea. There is satisfaction in bringing down the woman who, at times, has made her feel small, who had once made a comment about Hadia and Huda being already in their 20s and still not engaged, whose husband had in recent years been one of the men who pointed out to Rafiq the sight of Amar smoking beneath a streetlight, or asked why Amar did not participate in any of the youth events at mosque. The hypocrisy of knowing that the Ali boys also smoked. But Layla feels for Seema too, and does not want to hurt her so much as show her that neither of them were without children who would bring them pain and lower their name, or above having secrets that carry shame. To say to her, look more closely at what your daughter has done before you point a finger again at my son. I had no idea, Seema says. I had noticed her gone for hours at a time and never doubted her. We would have heard about it if someone else had seen them. But it is only a matter of time. Seema nods. I'm afraid I know my son. He hardly listens to us in the small matters. He will not listen to us if we tell him to end this. It will have to come from her. Of course, I will speak to her. We do not want to push them in a way that inspires them to take this friendship any further. I imagine that if I went to Amar and he decided not to listen to me, he could ask her to, God knows what, run away. It seems an impossible implication, but these things do happen. Seema drags her hands down her face. A tired sound escapes her. Boys will be boys, Layla says, the line they all know, especially in the face of apparent temptation. She has gone too far. Even she feels sour at having said it. But Seema only has Layla's word to rely on, and what she is imagining now will likely be worse than what the box contains. She does not want Amar to be accused of anything other than falling for Amira's advances. Seema swallows, lowers her gaze. She shakes her head in disbelief at some thought she does not voice, a glazed look on her face. I wish I could doubt you, Layla, but instead I feel as though I've always known this was coming. When, years ago, Amar would come to see my boys, Amira would always try to join them. I would tell her it was inappropriate. But, you know, it is hard to get them to realize the weight of what you're saying. I would tell her over and over, Amira, stop. Amira, there is no need to follow them around. Amira, what were you doing sitting with him on the couch? Amira is a fine girl, Layla offers. They are just being children. Amar is working very hard now on his studies. I do not want him to have any distraction, especially not a distraction like this. Have you told anyone? Only my husband, but no details. He does not know about the pictures or the content of the letters. Thank you, Seema says, and for a moment she looks like she will cry from relief. I will only tell mine too. I ask one favor. Seema looks at her. Please do not tell Amira how you found out. My son has a temper, and it has been a rough few years. He has just recently become responsible. I'm afraid that if he thinks that we were the ones who told her to end it, he will react against us and will not believe that Amira truly wants it to be over. He will try more to win her over. He can be so stubborn. Seema looks horrified at the idea of him winning her over, of both of them abandoning all decorum and continuing their childishness until it ruined them all. I understand. I, for one, have no problem with Amira knowing just how angry we are. We have never doubted our children. We have always trusted them. Now we know. It will be all right. They will learn from this. Yes, Seema says. There is a long silence, and neither wants to find something lighter to speak of. If our daughters act this way, Leila says, rising to her feet and placing the unfinished cup of tea on the table, what hope can we have for our sons? It was what Hadia had said once in passing that Leila could not shake. You have no idea what he does and what he hides. It returned to her as she snipped eggplants from the stem, as she chopped onions and watched them brown in hot oil. Where would her son hide what he wanted to keep secret? She remembered that birthday years ago, that box with a lock. On 6 different occasions, she had checked if he had left it unlocked while he was out. On the 7th try, when she saw it was ajar, the spare comforters thrown over it messily, she felt only excitement and an overwhelming curiosity. It was her right to know. She was his mother. When she looked through the journals and the photographs, the letters and the trinkets, she felt ill. Tickets to concerts he had never told them about. Neon wristbands to places she did not want to picture. For a moment, Leila glanced at Amar's journals, but she could barely make sense of his handwriting. Each deciphered sentence threatened to unravel her understanding of him, and carried with it the threat of more secrets. It did not matter that she was his mother. What she could ever hope to know of him was just a glimpse, like the beam of a lighthouse skipping out, only one stretch of waves visible at a time, the rest left in the unknowable dark. Hadia and Huda were their father's daughters. It was their father they tried to impress, his approval they sought. If he made a joke or even gestured toward a joke, they would laugh. She had known this when they were little girls at dinner time glancing at him to see if it was safe to speak. Had known it from the way their eyes delighted when he let them climb onto his back. He could switch seamlessly from playmate to parent, whereas Leila was stuck in the one role and was not given much authority even within the one. Amar was hers. He always had been. Sometimes she even thought that she and Amar were like friends when they walked grocery store aisles consulting each other before choosing the syrup or the chips flavor, and like friends when he tossed her fruits saying, "You can catch it, you can," and she would hesitate, but if she caught it, he'd cheer. And Amar asked about her day. Nearly no one did that. She could not deny that there was a part of her that could disregard the shock and the sin, and confess to herself that mostly she felt hurt, that there was so much he had hidden from her. She felt like she had brought it on herself, that had she not pried, she would not have known, and would have less to worry about. That night, they did not eat dinner as a family, and Leila was relieved. Amar took his dinner up to his bedroom, where he studied for his chemistry exam the next day. Leila waited until he was asleep before speaking with Rafiq in the amber light of their bedroom. He ran his hand along one side of his face, ruffling then smoothing his eyebrow. It was his habit when trying to think of a solution when presented with an impossible problem. "How far have they gone?" he finally asked. "It's unclear. They have photographs of each other in the same places but never together. His box is full of letters from her, promising herself to him. But other than how she felt during their meetings, there is no indication really of what, if anything, they have done."
"Does she love him?"
"They are children." He looked at her then.
"It makes a difference," he spoke slowly.
"What difference? What do children know about love when they have sacrificed nothing?"
He was bent forward, his elbow on his knee, his hand resting on his face in such a way that half of it was hidden from her.
"I thought you would be angrier," she said.
He shook his head.
"You surprise me."
"There is plenty to be angry with him about. But when you said you had found something, I thought you had come to me with more troubling news."
"This is troubling news."
"Yes."
"It would cause a scandal."
He nodded.
"The girl would be humiliated and soon after we would be. The Alis would never accept Amar," she said.
"What lack is there in our son?" Rafiq raised his voice. He dropped his hand from his face and looked at her, as though he had forgotten that he was the one who was always harsh toward Amar.
"Ask yourself, if you would feel, in good faith, able to give your daughter to someone like Amar."
Rafiq was speechless. After holding her gaze sternly for a moment, he looked down at his hands. "So what? We will never send a proposal on his behalf?" he said. A quality in his voice made her want to hold him.
"Of course not. He will continue to mature. He will make something of himself."
"He will never listen to us, Leila. If we tell him to stop this inappropriate, aap-e-se-bahar behavior, he will never listen."
"We won't tell him."
"So we let this continue, knowing that they have gone as far as to meet frequently. And that poor girl, we just allow him to continue to influence her to sin."
"We cannot.
She does not know any better. She does not know what she is doing, what this could lead to."
"Influence? She is the one tempting him."
Again he looked at her sternly. "Amar does not need any tempting, Leila. Don't forget what you already know."
"We could talk to Seema," she offered.
He shook his head.
"Think about it," she pressed. "Seema would be the first to want to keep it quiet. Her daughter would be the beghairat one, any way you look at it."
Rafiq started rubbing his eyebrow again. She reached out to touch his arm to say to him, "We are on the same side, remember?" "This could be good for Amar," he said finally. There was an unmistakable note of hope in his voice.
"How can you say that?"
"It could be. She's a good girl. I've always liked her. If it were made halal, she could influence him in the right way."
"You still think she is good?"
"Our son is no saint, Leila."
"They would never consider it," she said. And then, "Right now it is good for Amar. He is happy. He sneaks away smiling when his phone buzzes. He wakes up still sleepy after talking to her about who knows what all night. But what will happen in a week, in a month, when anyone else from the community finds out? In a year, when the girl gets proposals from someone with twice his qualifications?"
Rafiq sighed. He seemed, in that moment, suddenly very old to Leila.
"Every day this continues, it is worse for him. Every day that he has hope, it will only make the fall harder."
Leila thrusts the white sheet into the air, ridding it of any dust, then lowers it onto the lush grass.
Amar kneels at the corner of the sheet and tugs at the edges to straighten it. She smiles as he does so. His initiative, his consideration. The two of them leave their shoes in the grass and step into the center of the sheet to sit side by side, Amar leaning slightly on her leg. They watch Rafiq walk toward them, the lower half of his face hidden by the basket of food he carries. Huda runs a little to match his steady stride, her tight ponytail swaying. Hadia struggles behind them. Her lips are pressed together in concentration as she juggles a plastic bag filled with paper cups, plates, plastic utensils in one hand, the plastic bag twisting and tightening its grip on her wrist, and a large bottle of lemonade in the other. Layla made it earlier in the day, fresh and frosted from the ice that melts in it. "Ow," Layla says, looking up to Rafiq. "Come." She is squinting because of the sun, tapping twice at the empty space beside her. Something about the sweet air, the soft breeze, the cool grass that sinks beneath her weight, makes her feel bold enough to call for her husband to sit beside her, despite the presence of her children. It could be because he has granted their wish, or because neither can deny the beauty of the day, the contagious excitement of their children. Beneath this sky, in this park tucked away from the main freeway, a side of her husband she has not often seen is brought out. This could be how he appears when he's relaxing. He comments on the cloudless sky, the birds that sing with voices that do not pester quite as much as the ones by his window. "But Baba," Hadia says to him, "they are the same." The sun still in the center of the sky does not burn. Rafiq lies on his back and cushions his head on his interlocked hands. Layla pours lemonade into paper cups and passes them into the eager hands of her children. Days like this, days out, just the five of them, are rare. Her children are buzzing with the knowledge of its uniqueness. They might have thanked Rafiq 100 times. "It's a lovely way to spend a Sunday, isn't it?" she says, regretting immediately how calling attention to the loveliness of a thing diminishes its magic. Rafiq, his eyes hidden behind his dark sunglasses, nods solemnly. Amar looks up at her, radiant, she imagines, from considering himself responsible for the day. After dinner yesterday, before the plates had been cleared and the children sent to bed, he asked if they could go on a picnic. And Rafiq said, "Why don't we do that?" Layla had smiled, surprised at the spontaneity of her husband, and said she could make food they could take along. Hadia said, "Tangerines." Huda said, "Lemonade." Amar said, "River." "We can try," Rafiq said to them. "I might know a place for us." There is a river nearby, past the trees that surround them, past where the meadow dips beyond their sight. The sound of water moving, the gurgling, tugs at Amar, and he taps her leg when he hears it. Huda points to a far-off playground and asks Rafiq if he will take them there after they've eaten. They are asking for things openly, without hesitation, pausing for a moment after they do, before Rafiq's nod, out of fear that their good fortune has run out and soon routine will resume. "It was a good idea, Amar," Layla assures him, using the kind of voice she always strives for when speaking with her children. He responds with a brighter smile, pleased with himself, looks to his sisters to see if they have noticed the praise. They eat lunch cross-legged on the sheet, cradling the plate Layla has prepared for each of them. Layla made cashew curry chicken sandwiches, rich from the taste of peppers, crunchy from the lettuce. Hadia compliments them, and for once, Huda does not complain about the taste of the chicken, masked as it is in sauce and spice. When they are finished, they share tangerines and stories from Hadia's and Huda's classrooms that Amar listens to so seriously, popping the tangerine slices into his mouth and chewing slowly. He always watches them intently when they speak of school. He is only 4, and Leila thought to skip preschool and wait until kindergarten, not wanting an empty home just yet. He is fascinated by that unknown world. When they drop Huda and Hadia off, she looks back at him in the rearview mirror, how he stretches his neck to watch wide-eyed and open-mouthed as his sisters join the crowd, their lunchboxes swinging at their sides. After they eat, Huda asks again about the swings, and Rafiq lets her climb onto his back for a piggyback ride. Hadia follows them. "Do you want to go?" Leila nudges Amar. They watch as the three of them make their way, Huda laughing when Rafiq mimics a trotting horse. Amar shakes his head, presses his tongue against the inside of his chubby cheek. Leila stands and brushes the crumbs off of her yellow shalwar kameez and scans the meadow, the playground, the sparse picnic tables, some occupied with families not unlike her own, young children and young parents. "Come with me," she says, bending down a bit so he can reach her hand. He holds on, and she pulls him up. He is still light enough for her to do so with ease. The sound of water guides them. Before they have disappeared into the trees that will block Rafiq and the girls from her sight, she turns back to see they have reached the swings. Rafiq touches the back of one and sends her forth, just as the other lands against his palm. From where she stands, he appears exactly like the kind of man she would want for the father of her children, a man who knows how to lift them onto the rubber seats of the swing, knows with what gentle force to push them, knows how something as small as saying yes to a picnic would please them so uncomplicatedly. Amar lets go of her hand and walks ahead. It takes so little, just the slightest touch of his hand against their backs, and their bodies soar. Their laughter reaches her, and she's shocked by a plunge inside her. Her affection for Rafiq surges, and she wonders if she has ever loved him the way she loves him now.
"Mama," Amar calls with urgency. "Let's go."
He waits for her a few feet ahead, holding out his hand. "Speak in Urdu, Ami," she reminds him. Ever since Hadia first learned English in school, it has been difficult to make any of them speak in Urdu. They speak in English, and so quickly that they sound like little trains zooming by. They act as though it were the superior language, the more stylish one. She has to make it a game at dinner to encourage them. It confuses her. Urdu is the language she and Rafiq speak with one another, and all they ever spoke with the children. But one goes to school, and the others pick it up like wildfire, as if they've forgotten their own tongue entirely. It worries her. If they so easily lose their own language, what else will be lost? The wind lifts her yellow orni up like a kite, and it covers her face. Amar begins to laugh and laugh. Rafiq has heard him, and he turns around. Leila restrains the orni and waves, points to where they are walking, and Rafiq nods. She catches up to Amar and grabs hold of his hand, so small in hers. He won't let her hold his hand for much longer. As they walk downhill, the grass becomes a tangled mess, then just dirt. Amar pulls her along, and Leila realizes she wants another child. Rafiq would not want another. He was an only child, and had been against even having a third. "Just one more," she had said after Huda. And after a few years, Amar had been born. After the scare that was Amar's birth, and the stressful first weeks of his life, it would be even harder to broach the topic of a fourth. Amar leads her down the slope, and they try to steady their footing. Another child. A boy, for Amar to have a brother. A baby that would extend that feeling of a small hand in hers
for a little longer.
When they first glimpse the water, Amar rushes forward and asks to be allowed in. Layla hesitates. Recently she heard of a child, a little girl, no older than 7, playing in a river, when her parents turned their backs for just a moment. The current rising and quickening without warning, the girl swept away, struggling to lift her head above the water. Layla shivers, reaches out to touch the soft hair of her son, moves it from his eyes.
"Can I, Mama?"
He uses that irresistible and manipulative voice that he, like all children, perfected so early on. She does not remember being a child capable of such powers. The water before them is not cause for alarm. The river seems shallow, more like a creek. It moves quickly, but with an unthreatening swiftness. The deepest end is likely no deeper than her knees, and she sees the soft surface of rocks, their edges worn away from time and the rush of the current. Amar can stand on them and move from one to the other without cutting his feet. She kneels and removes his shoes, and he begins to tap her shoulders excitedly as she rolls his jeans up to his knees, tight enough that they won't fall, and she steps back and watches him turn to the creek, take it all in. How it must appear vaster to him than it does to her. He extends just one shaky leg forward, dips a toe in, and pulls it back out again, testing the temperature. Then he steps forward without looking back. She finds it strange that she feels a tinge of hurt that he does not turn back. The water ripples at his presence and quickly reforms around him. The tip of each wave looks painted gold, dashes here and there where the sunlight shimmers. She watches her son bend down to feel the water flow between his fingers. And it seems impossible to her that something would break this precious space, or how she feels here, how the wind and the birds and the gurgle of water sound like music. It feels impossible that there could be days when it was not like this for them. Her children's fingers sticky with tangerine juice, her husband so calm, his face so relaxed, that when he lies on their picnic sheet, she wonders if he has fallen asleep. Amar cups the water in his hands and throws it up and laughs, and it feels as if nothing could interrupt the bliss of the moment, bliss as bright as the sun that glimmers on the water, as light as her daughter's girlish laughter. As light.
Mama,
Amar calls out to her, standing in the center of the creek, cupping the water in his hands and releasing it.
Come.
Layla shakes her head. But he begins to gesture with his hands to call her, little drops flying from his fingers. Her son is persistent and demanding. He knows what he wants and is devastated if he does not attain it. It alarms her. How little it takes to darken his mood.
I can't,
she replies, cupping her palms around her mouth so her voice can reach him.
Mama, please. Feel how cold. My clothes will get too wet, Ami. Roll them like me, please, Mama.
He does not appear as happy as he was a moment ago. Layla looks down at the shalwar that covers her legs, not wanting to reveal them. She turns around and can't see Rafiq from here. He must still be swinging the girls. She looks back at Amar calling her, unaware of what he is asking of her. The slope protects them from view. Here it is just she and her son. She can decide how they move through the world, to each other. She can do this. Bend down and lift her shalwar and join him. What does it matter? She ties her orni at her hip, so it won't get away. She rolls up her shalwar a little bit, then a little more, until it is just above her knees. Amar claps, throws water into the air. The splashes descend like the tails of a golden firework. Her legs are pale. The breeze is colder on bare skin than she imagined. She cannot call forth the last time the sun saw her skin. She feels like a girl. Amar notices nothing, not her nervousness, not her hesitation. "Yes, Mummy," he shouts in celebration, as though they had been playing a game and she had given him the correct answer. She steps into the water and is surprised not only by how cold it is, but also how refreshing. She looks down at her feet that appear contorted. She chooses each stone carefully and thinks, this is what it is to be alive. This is what being alive can be like. What would Rafiq say if he saw her?
Mama, mama.
Amar is saying it like a cheer, and Layla realizes she cannot control her laughter, so unrestrained and inaccessible before now. The stones are smooth beneath her feet, the current both insistent and relenting. This is a moment that lifts and becomes a memory, even as it is happening. And she knows this will be the meadow she will try to return to, her son's voice the sound she will try to recall. One day she will look back and think, it was not bad. We were so blessed. There were days like this, sunny and beautiful, when Amar looked up at me as I reached him in the river and said, I'm so happy we did this, Mama. Days when Rafiq's mood was as carefree as a ripple of water in a stream. There were times when I watched Hadia unpeel the skin of the tangerine with tiny thumbs and fingers with such precision and technique. The peel not tearing once. And I thought, how did she learn how to do that? I was certainly not the one to teach her. And she offered the tangerine whole to her brother, did not demand a piece in return, then peeled one for her sister before she even asked. And Huda rose to say, I'll throw the peels away. And maybe it was the same thoughtfulness that touched me that made Huda want to do something in return. Huda cupped her hands, and Hadia let the peels fall like little petals into her sister's palms. And I thought, these are my children, mine, laughing together. And that is when I met Rafiq's gaze, and he looked like I must have, swelling with so much pride. It was apparent on his face, on mine. So apparent that we both had to look away, made shy from the force and depth of a feeling we did not expect. Part 3. 1. The wedding had barely begun, and already Layla could not locate Amar. Layla had been frustrated when Hadia had said, she wanted a mixed wedding. An unsegregated wedding marked a family who valued entertainment over adherence. But as she searched the hall for her son now, she felt grateful for her daughter's insistence. Across the hall, she met Rafiq's gaze. As though the look on her face were enough to convey her fear, Rafiq began to scan the hall. Layla stepped out into the lobby, where guests mingled, held small plates of appetizers, and sipped juice from thin glass flutes. Pineapple, orange, mango. There he was. She could spot the outline of her child in an instant. He was looking down at his plate, nodding along to a conversation. She stepped closer. His suit, sharp, and his hair combed. He was more than presentable. He was handsome. Someone she could point to with pride and say, yes, that one there is my son. Amar was speaking to a woman. She was facing him and was partially obscured by people walking past.
You found him?
Rafiq appeared at her side. The people blocking her view stepped away. The woman turned her head enough for a sliver of her profile to be glimpsed. It was her.
Amira Ali.
Rafiq studied Leila, as though waiting for her to react.
Should we be worried?
He asked. The Ali girl had wasted no time in finding her son. The sight of the two of them together unearthed an old discomfort. She looked to see if Seema was nearby, but she was not. Amar and the girl spoke unattended.
No, she said. And not sure who she was reassuring, she continued. It has been years.
She smiled at Rafiq, but quickly turned back to them. Amar was not looking at her. Amira Ali was the one speaking. Even from a distance, Leila could note the playful tilt in her head as she looked up at Amar. How her hair danced as she moved. Her son played with the food on his plate, but did not lift his fork. Leila had not seen Amira Ali in years. She had moved across the country for college, visited infrequently. She had never come again to their home, not even after Amar left. Amira stepped away from Amar and walked toward the main hall. Amar seemed unbothered by her departure. Leila let out a breath she did not realize she had been holding. Rafiq returned to mingling. Many of the attendees were his co-workers or his oldest friends from Hyderabad. Leila watched Amira Ali walk. Girlishness had left her. Her cheeks had lost their fullness and given way to high cheekbones, an angular and attractive face. Her lips painted and lashes darkened. She was poised, her spine straight, her step steady. Her childhood charm was now confidence. She maneuvered through the crowd, unaware that Leila was watching. And Leila was hit with the strange sensation of realizing she had left something behind and forgotten to turn back for it. But what was it? She wondered, as Amira Ali reached up to tuck her dark hair behind her ear, revealing that heavy, ornate jewelry of Hyderabad, the circular gold earrings with the emeralds and dangling pearls. It would be impossible now, years later, to retrace her steps and find again what it was that had slipped her mind, what she had forgotten to turn back for. Of all he had predicted, all he had feared or hoped for, Amira suggesting they meet in private had not even occurred to him. Nor had he thought he would respond so effortlessly, with no pride or hesitation keeping him from agreeing. It repulsed him that all the work he had done to convince himself he no longer wanted her, did not even want to hear from her, could be so quickly unraveled. The piece of chicken and samosa on his plate. He should force himself to eat, but his hands trembled. He could not look at her while she spoke. But as she walked away, with her posture of being seen, he had looked.
There's a courtyard on the other side of the hotel, down a long corridor, empty this time of night, she had said.
It was the same corridor that led to the hotel bar.
We could meet there? She asked.
He had not known what to say. So she continued saying, maybe when the nikah and speeches were done, when people sat down to eat dinner and everyone was distracted. She had formed a plan. Perhaps she had hoped he would be here, just so they could execute it. By the time she disappeared into the main hall, he was in a state of disbelief. That they would meet again. That even if they did not speak to or see each other, they still felt that care and curiosity. For 3 years now, he had returned to their last conversations, embittered at the thought of being discarded. But seeing her now, the deep green of her dress with the red accents, her golden shoes he concentrated on while she spoke. Any bitterness was made insignificant by the overwhelming sight of her, and the chance to once again step toward a place that would be made theirs.
As Mama instructed, Hadia sat far enough away from Tariq that two hands could rest between them. She made sure to not laugh too loudly, to not touch him, to not appear, in Mama's words, shamelessly eager to be married. It was an absurd expectation placed on women, that they agree to marriage without appearing as though they wanted it, that they at least display innocence. Hadia never understood what was so threatening about a woman experiencing a desire and being unafraid to express it. But on the stage now, she complied with Mama's wishes, remembering how Mama had told her, "You chose your husband. He's not Shia. Please do us the kindness of not making it appear so obviously a love marriage." She was getting married to who she wanted. Her mother might say it like an accusation, but the fact remained true. She had won the biggest battle, the battle that would determine the rest of her life. She and Tariq had just begun to see each other when Amar ran away. Even now, she was not sure if it had been a coincidence that what had been previously dormant in her friendship with Tariq had suddenly bloomed and intensified. At first, Hadia had hesitated to be with him, to maybe marry him. He was not Hyderabadi, and he was not Shia. He did not speak Urdu. And though he was, in many ways, familiar to her, he was also relaxed in his approach to his faith, in a way that was new to Hadia. He had smoked weed in college and had tried alcohol. He did not feel guilty when they began to spend time alone together, the way she had at first. He prayed, but struggled to maintain a disciplined routine. Next to him, Hadia became more aware of her choices, of what was important for her to keep, and what had just been an inherited, unexamined habit. On and on she explored, and was thrilled at the exploration. Fasting was important. Cursing did not matter. She deeply respected hijab, but did not wear it for herself. Her faith became a highly personal affair. What did it matter what others believed? She had friends of other faiths or no faith at all. She could be in a room where people were drinking. She would sip water and make no fuss of it. She could hold in her heart a belief in Islam, as well as the unwavering belief that every human had the right to choose who they loved and how, and that belief was in exact accordance with her faith, that it is the individual's right to choose, and the individual's duty to empathize with one another. Didn't the Quran itself contain the verse, "We have created you from many tribes, so you may know one another"? Her family had impressed upon her a specific belief, and in a specific way. And as a young woman, she had not known, when she touched her forehead to the ground, if she was praying to God because Mama had reminded her to, or if it was her own desire. Being with Tariq allowed her to stretch herself while also remaining fundamentally herself. It was not that they made the same choices, so much as he understood hers and she his. He might not accompany her to mosque during the first 10 days of Muharram, but he did not turn the radio on when they drove together in those days either. And for her, on Ashura, he wore black. Theirs was a love that acknowledged the individual as separate from the whole, from the family as a unit. Now Tariq's sister's heels tapped against the stairs as they made their way up to the stage. His sisters hugged her first, then Tariq, and then sat on the couches beside them that were set up for the guests. The wedding would go on this way. The guests would come up in clusters, sit with them briefly, and then leave the stage. She leaned in to wipe lipstick from the chin of Isra, Tariq's youngest sister. Hadia felt at ease with them. She wanted Tariq to feel it too. She wanted him to meet Amar and think, as she did now with Isra, that this family will be mine, that any brother of my wife is a brother of mine.
Are the appetizers no good?
Mama asked Amar as he set the plate down to be cleared. She watched him intently, and he remembered why he had sought out food in the first place. He had downed one whiskey and wanted to eat something to mask the smell. He turned his face from her before he answered.
I'm not hungry.
Everything is all right?
Yes.
Sachi? She asked in Urdu, truly? It was one word, but it had the effect of implying that his first response had not been honest, and that he needed to be pressed for truth.
Truly.
Mama smiled. I would like to introduce you to some of my friends, she said.
Friends?
He teased her. He had never known Mama to have friends. She had women from the community who gathered by habit in the same mosque halls for the same events, who had formed something like a friendship after years of routine. She grabbed his arm and pulled him toward the main hall.
You think you're the only one with friends? She joked.
Amar suddenly felt sorry for his mother. Sorry that maybe the only thing she had in common with these women was that they had migrated to the same place, sought the same shelter.
Ami? Mama asked, her voice soft. Where should we say you have been?
His stomach tightened. He traced his teeth with his tongue for any taste of the drink. He had arrived at the last minute, partially so he would not be able to change his mind, and partially so they would have less time to speak of it.
Your father and I, after...
We began to tell people you had gone to India to be with my sister. He had made it difficult for them. They lied for him and were not asking him for an explanation.
I can tell them that.
She held on tight to his arm and then let go.
Only if they ask.
He nodded. He felt at the edge of discomfort, made worse by how desperately Mama was trying to protect him from discomfort. He could lean into the feeling as it advanced toward him, or he could deny it and remain present.
You have a choice, Amar,
Hadia had advised him years ago. All of us are in the same boat, but you're the only one who chooses to thrash about, making unnecessary waves.
You can be still. You can go with the flow. That way you'll save energy to swim when you need to.
She was prone to using one metaphor after another, and sometimes the connections between them did not make sense. It would have been more effective if Hadia had used only one. But he never told her this. He could be still. Go where the night took him. Layla did not like lying. If she were to be honest with herself, there was no point. Nothing hidden remained so. Time had a way of unearthing the truth. She would rather not speak than speak falsely. She imagined what others might say behind her back. Poor Layla and Rafiq, what a test has befallen them. Saying their son has been in India when everyone knows he ran away, became an unbeliever, gave them no account of his secret life. But he was her son. It did not matter what he had done or where he had been. Not when he was back now. A table of her friends had unwrapped the golden favor boxes and were unfolding the ayat Huda had designed and printed about the love and mercy God placed between the hearts of couples.
What a beautiful wedding this is, they said to her, and stood to greet her.
The chairs had been draped with white cloth, tied together with a golden bow. She hugged them one after another, taking in the varied scents of their perfumes. She touched Amar's arm, and he stepped forward.
This is my son, Amar.
It had been years since she had spoken the words.
Mashallah, he looks just like Rafiq,
one said.
Exact,
another agreed, pinching her fingers together for emphasis.
Amar lowered his head and lifted his cupped hand to meet it. It was a small gesture, adab, but Leila was instantly moved by how he had thought to do so without her reminding him. Her friends reached out to touch his head, and they all said, "Jeete raho, keep living, keep living."
"Leila, you look too young to be the mother of a young man," Khadija said.
Amar smiled at that. Leila told Amar about Khadija, who had just recently moved from Hyderabad to live with her son and daughter-in-law.
"Do you like it here?" Amar asked in Urdu,
and Leila was again touched. He had used the respectful aap. Why had she assumed he had forgotten? The two of them talked, Khadija telling Amar how she had adjusted to California, the pleasant air and hills, an ocean nearby, and Amar asking her questions in a broken Urdu that was making them laugh.
"That's one thing that's a shame," Khadija said, turning then to Leila, "that the children here have forgotten their language. I fear for my grandchildren."
Leila gripped the loose fabric of her sari tight. The little beads bit into her skin. She did not want to nod and agree with Khadija, not in front of Amar, and not at all.
"Nice to meet you," Amar said to her in English after a while.
He stepped back into the crowd. Leila excused herself too, and walked off as though called by an errand. Khadija had raised her children in India. Her son had moved here alone. He was what her children would teasingly call a fob, fresh off the boat, what she liked to remind them that their own parents were once. Leila was 20 when the proposal from Rafiq came. She looked at Hadia now, 27, and seated on the stage, surrounded by Tariq's sisters. But she still seemed so young to Leila. On the eve of her own wedding night, while the Mehndi lady covered her hands with henna and drew in Rafiq's initials, the life that awaited her was a blur. She could picture just the corner of the apartment they would live in, the outline of the hills. At that point, she had seen Rafiq in person twice, had received from him 5 letters her mother read before giving them to her, had written him back 4 that her mother had checked and made her rewrite before allowing the envelope to be sealed and stamped. Rafiq had sent photographs with each letter, the hills green and empty of houses, the wide gray roads and the street lamps curved at the top like drooping flowers. The promise, he would purchase plane tickets for her parents to visit them. Her father would turn to her flapping the photographs around like a fan, saying,
"Leila Jani, Leila Rani, look. It is exactly like my paintings, and how entirely appropriate that a place like a painting is where my daughter's destiny lies."
Almost 30 years ago, Leila had herself been a bride, walking to the stage where Rafiq waited, her sight obscured by rows of thick flowers she was not allowed to peek through. How was she to know then what it would be like to raise her children in an unfamiliar land, a land that held no history for her, but the one they were making together? "Bismillah," she repeated, as her sister held her to guide her to Rafiq. "I begin in the name of God." She had never traveled out of Hyderabad before. She was like the women in the novels or the movies, the ones who stepped onto a plane or boat and watched their world shrink behind them. The compassionate, the merciful, the scent of jasmine and roses. Wondering only if her husband would be a kind man or a stern one. Tariq asked her how much longer the smiling and greeting would continue. He gestured at his jaw. Hers ached too. Never had she sustained a smile for so long. During conversations and the moments between when the photographer asked them to look up. She scanned the wedding hall. the rows of chandeliers twinkling, casting golden light on the tables beneath them. People she had seen all her life, seated at the tables, leaning into one another, laughing and talking. The guest list reflected more her parents' and Tariq's parents' circles than theirs. But neither she nor Tariq wanted to take that from them. The women had gathered on the right side of the hall, and the men on the left. No partition, so everyone could move freely, especially the teenagers, who wandered in hope of stealing a glance or bumping into a particular boy or girl. Hadia smiled to remember what that had been like. One by one, the guests came to greet them, and Amar had not come. Had still not met Tariq. Had the thought even occurred to him? She spotted Huda and waved her over. She had not intended to lower her voice and speak quickly in Urdu, but when Huda's face was close to hers, she did. Tariq's parents spoke Urdu, but he and his siblings had not learned it. Hadia had not realized how important it would be for her, until she found she kept wanting to speak to him in the language she used with Mama and Baba, the language she slipped into when afraid, or when she stubbed her toe against the desk. She had begun to sense that there was a barrier between them, unnoticed on most days, but still obstructing a complete intimacy, the intimacy of home. And sometimes she felt unreasonably that, until she called for him in her first language and he returned her call, they would not be truly, completely a family. She did not want Tariq to know that her own brother had to be urged to meet him. She wanted Amar to walk up of his own volition, but if he did not come soon, it would be time for the speeches. Huda gave her a look, not of sympathy or pity, but something in between, one that said that Hadia should know better than to care, than to have any expectation from Amar at all. He wandered from the hall out into the lobby, and then back into the hall again. Where he really wanted to go was the bar, but he could not go back there. But what was the difference between one drink and one more? There was none. Only after a few was there an effect. One drink was like none at all, like a sip of water. He had two things on his mind, and they took turns occupying his thoughts. To be free, momentarily, of one was to soon be assailed by the other. The first was that in an hour, maybe less, he would walk out to the courtyard to meet Amira. The second was that his father had still not spoken to him properly. When Amar looked out across the hall, his father was on the other side, as though they were following separate orbits. Just before they had left for the wedding, Amar had looked out the sliding door at his father walking in the backyard. The mist that time of day, the bluing light, his father's green sweater and white kurta rippling. It had been 3 years, and Amar wondered, what do I feel now? He was still angry. It was an anger that had been useful to him. To step out from his home and never return to their street, not even to drive by at the darkest hour of the night. An anger he touched like a totem to gain strength. They do not understand me, and make no attempt to. I can't be like them. On and on it went, each thought taking him farther to a place he could not return from. But hours earlier, when he watched his father in the garden, he realized that the anger had dimmed. And he was surprised to find that after anger, or alongside it, was not a bitterness or resentment, but regret. Afsos was the word in Urdu. There was no equivalent in English. It was a specific kind of regret. Not wishing he had acted differently, but a helpless sadness at the situation as it was.